Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries, produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This year, the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books did something unusual. It brought in many writers from independent presses. It brought editors and publishers of important new and growing presses. And so today we have a show. We're talking about the editing and preparation of books with an editor, Ethan Nasowski, a writer, the Norwegian writer Per Pedersen, and a publisher, Geir Berdahl, who is the publisher for 36 years at October Books. You probably know of October Books because they published the Karl Ove Knausgård series as well as Per Pedersen's books. When I started doing this show many years ago, I knew what an editor did. I'm not sure I do anymore. Ethan Nasowski has been at some of the best positions from which to report what an editor does. He started at one of the literary houses in New York, Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He moved on to the wonderful Grey Wolf Press. Then he went to McSweeney's, and then, as if to, you know, make a statement, I think, almost, he went back, no one does this, to Grey Wolf Press, where they created a position for him known as editorial director. So, Ethan Nasowski, what does an editor do?
It's a two-part job. The first part of it is to act as a scout for books that my company might be interested in publishing and to get those books under contract. That's sort of begins with a simple act, which is whether you like or dislike a book, and if you like it, trying to get it under contract, which is the business part, and then working with the author to prepare a manuscript for publication, to work through with the author through multiple drafts and make sure it's the best possible version of itself that it can be. Increasingly, probably over the last several decades, editors' jobs don't stop there. You have to think about how to position the book in the market and figure out who will read it and who might review it. So there's a little bit more thought to marketing publicity now than certainly when I began my career.
Now, Per Pedersen, the author of the new book, I Refuse, and the very famous breakthrough novel, Outstealing Horses. What is your experience of working with editors like? Is it troubled? Is it rapturous? What is it?
Well, I always liked it. In one way, because they don't interfere that much, I think. I don't know if that's because of them or me. But I've had four Norwegian different editors, and they've all been very good in different things. And my first one, of course, was the most important in a way, because I worked in a bookshop then, and he went to sort of took me out of the bookshop and said, finish writing, because you can't stand there all your life. Everybody knows you want to write, and yet you do secretly come to us. And so he taught me a lot. He was the kind of red pencil kind of editor, and I learned a lot from him. And the best lesson I learned from him was that when you're worried about the whole of the book, don't worry. If it's good in the part, it will be good. in the whole.
Now, I have absolutely no idea not just what Geir Berdahl does, but what any publisher does. What is a publisher?
A publisher have to think forward, long forward, how to build a publishing house. And that's what I have done. Because October was a left-wing publishing house. October name is from the October Revolution. Yes. But in the 79, it's were no left-wing more. Then we have to build a fiction. I want to build a fiction publishing house. I've done that in 36 years. And in the beginning, we had one, two, three fiction authors. But one of them was the new generation's best writer, Dag Solstad. And he go with me. He and another writer called Jon Michelet, we go together and built the publishing house. And today we have 110 writers, fiction writers, Norwegian, and we are the leading company in Norway, the most leading.
Wow. Well, you know, certainly Karl Ove Knausgård took the globe. I mean, this is a book that it is said, if it's true, that one out of six Norwegians have read My Struggle by Knausgård, and that this is...
Yeah.
Is it so?
The story of Karl Ove Knausgård is so that he hadn't written a book for 4 or 5 years. We gave him money so he could write, and he delivered come with the manuscript, 700 pages, and he said he wanted to write 1,500 pages, and I said, we can cut it in two volumes. No, I can't do that, he said. Okay, I said, we can print it in 12 volumes in 200 pages, and he said, wow. And then he began to write the sixth volume, and he used many of the things in the manuscript, and I think it's released him or liberated him. And we thought we should sell 5,000, but we sold many 100,000.
What extraordinary success. Now, at one time, it was said in America, I think Ethan can agree with me, that rich fathers bought publishing houses for their overly sensitive children to manage and have something to do. They couldn't go into the family business. They were too rebellious. So you bought them a publishing house, and that was the connection to the money. That's what I always thought. Is that true? First, Ethan, you tell me. Well, is that your experience?
That was, you know, my first real editorial job in publishing was at Farrar, Straus & Giroux when it was still a independent family-owned company run by Roger Strauss. Who was one of those rich boys, although he created the place himself, but certainly lost money on it for a very long time. And that's true, too, of James Lachlan from New Directions, who lost money on it for decades. And the important thing there is that it's important to lose money for a little while because the world doesn't always catch up to the literature that you're publishing.
You assembled the most interesting people you knew, and you published their books, and you weren't worried about losing money because there was someone, maybe your family, who could sponsor this. And they were willing to because they were making money elsewhere. Yeah?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Strauss is also quite shrewd in that he would always say, never forget about the business side of publishing. So he... You know, early on, he would publish, you know, Francis the Talking Mule or so, you know, was some early book in the, I think, the 40s or the 50s, or he would publish some diet books. And so sometimes he would sort of, I'd say, almost stumble into money. But at a place like that was a for-profit company, they were always trying to balance the core of the list, which was a huge amount of poetry and translation, literary fiction, you know, with books that could, you know, could sustain that. But I think sometimes the priorities get backwards with the larger publishers, where they're, the goal is to, you know, publish the money making books, and then you squeeze in the literary books.
We're talking to an editor, a publisher, and a writer. We're talking about the way in which publishing has changed, has stayed the same. For many years, it was said that publishers were slow on the uptake in terms of publishing electronic literature, and that this explains the crisis in publishing today. Now, Ethan, is publishing in crisis now? Ethan Nosowski.
I think, honestly, we're in a golden age of publishing. No, I really do. I truly do. I know it sounds crazy. I didn't feel this way even 5 years ago, or certainly not 10 years ago. I think we were all quite nervous, and that gets to your point about ebooks. And I think publishers are now able to work with them more enthusiastically and not feel like they're an existential threat to the business. But I think there is so much good work being done by such a variety of presses. I think that despite what years ago was the complete disappearance of the review media and newspapers, that I do think we're starting to see more authoritative outlets and magazines online. And I think there's good critical writing around in a way that I hadn't seen for a little while. I think independent bookstores have seen a resurgence, certainly at least in urban areas, in New York, San Francisco here, good bookstores that have good taste and that will help people find the good books that they didn't know that they wanted to read.
Per, what do you find? Your career now is, what, in America it's around 10 years, but in Norway you've been known as a writer for around 20 years. What do you notice?
Well, I think that we are in a golden age, at least in a way October is. I think every year we have this, you know, the Writers Union Congress. And when I sit there in among the others, I have this strong feeling of being sitting inside Norwegian literature that has kind of a substance. And in Sweden and Denmark, they say there's a golden age in Norway. What's happening, you know? And then we have, like, suddenly Knausgård happens out of not nowhere, but wow. And the amazing thing with October still just publishes fiction and poetry. And
it's beautiful.
It lives by that. Even
but there's
a good turnover, you know? They don't lose money now.
Yeah.
They have to have miracles, though.
Yes.
You know, every like in October, they are so worried. Something has to happen or we go bankrupt. And then a miracle comes every year.
These are always the best publishing stories, are the ones that are the surprises. I remember, you know, at FSG, that, you know, of course we need
at
Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux. We needed Tom Wolfe or Scott Turow to be bestsellers. But what would be the most delightful thing, I think, for everybody there was suddenly Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf is on the New York Times bestseller list, or Ted Hughes's poems, The Birthday Letters. And similarly at Grey Wolf, the more we do what we do, the more we stick to the books that we're good at publishing, the better those sell. Sometimes it's the stranger books that do quite well for us. You know, I think of Claudia Rankine's Citizen that we published this year, which is sold in large numbers, and it's an experimental work of hybrid criticism and poetry with images. And sometimes if you stick to what you know how to do, you're rewarded for that.
Mm. I think I'm experiencing something unexpected. You see, most of the time, this conversation would be about the war between art and commerce. But I think I'm talking to three people deep in the heart of publishing for whom it's not a war. Artistic books can be commercial successes. You don't have to always regard those successes as acts of prostitution or giving way to popular taste. I'm talking to three people who can be happy with their jobs. How could this be? At this late moment of capitalism?
Well, you have to be content not making very much money, I guess.
Never underestimate the readers. If they can hear about the books, if they have to communicate to them. And many people, some reviewers from my last book, they say, isn't it a little difficult with all these times and the different voices? And a couple of them said that. But when I walk in the streets of Oslo and people come up to me and say, "Oh, great book." And he's like a plumber or something, which is really good. And I said, "Wasn't it a little difficult with all these, you know?"
Yeah,
No, I just looked at the top there. You said exactly what, that's the way you wanted it to be, wasn't it? Yes, I thought. Yeah, that's what I thought. No problem.
I got the most moving letter of my life. It said, "I'm a flake out from community college, and I work as a part-time janitor. But I listened to your show and I found out what to read. And believe me, I live in a place where they don't know who Chekhov is, let alone William Vollman. And maybe I know two people, a retired professor and a bookstore owner. And they talk to me. But the show, you are my conversation." And I think that's true. The experiment, if there is an experiment today, is how to get the book to the reader. That is the experimental procedure that needs to be examined, new strategies invented, new inventivenesses invented. Yeah? When in Norway, Karl Ove Knausgård comes out with a 6-volume fictional autobiography, is that an easy sell?
No, it's not easy. Because it's 1,100 pages thick. He wanted to be 1,500 pages. And I said, we can't print thicker than 1,100 pages. So you have to cut and cut and cut.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. And I'm talking with Ethan Nosowski over at Grey Wolf Press. Per Pedersen, the great living Norwegian writer, 7 or 8 of whose books have been published in America, 2 of them bestsellers, and Geir Berdal, who has not only the biggest publishing house in Norway, but the most artistic one. Isn't this amazing? We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Per Pedersen, Ethan Nosowski, and Geir Berdal about the process of editing, publishing, writing. Can we begin by acknowledging implicitly here that what we're talking about all across the board is a triumph in translation and that a revolution has been brought about by a number of people? There are people I know, a person at, is it Syracuse University?
Chad Post,
who publishes a press called Open Letter, where the students learn by doing translations. That all over, Dalkey Archive Press, the absolutely wonderful New Directions, Grey Wolf, Milkweed, Coffee House. These are presses that are finding their feet by making readers aware that there's not just a bunch of writing programs across America. There's an international, a global literature. All of us have something to say about the times in which we're living.
I think that's true, and our culture is the richer for it. There's also some of these publishers, and it was true of Roger Strauss at FSG in the late 40s, that's opportunistic about this, which is that it can be very expensive for a press with very little money to publish the most obvious writers writing in English because there's a lot of competition. But there are so many untranslated, wonderful writers in every country in the world that there's a lot to choose from that doesn't always cost the publishers quite as much to acquire. And that was Roger Strauss started with publishing some Alberto Moravia in the 50s or something, or El Smirante, and because you know he'd gone to an agent and they said, why should I send a book to you instead of to Mr. Knopf or Bennett Cerf, you know? And he didn't have a good answer for them. So he went abroad and found some foreign books. And I think that's been true of some of the smaller presses, too, with editors who have other language skills. Jill Schulman of Archipelago, who's Karlov is American publisher, reads several languages, and she's able to make good decisions on her own. I do think there are a lot more people realizing that there's a lot more good literature that there's space for in the American market now.
Tell me, Per Pedersen, was publication in America a thing that you lusted for? What does it mean to be published in America for a Norwegian writer?
Well, it's a big thing, isn't it? But I never lusted for it. I never even thought about it, in fact. But there was, my novel To Siberia was translated. We came out in Norway in 1996. It was translated into English by Christopher Backelhaus at Harville Press in 1999. And that was wow. Are you interested? Somebody had told him about the book that he trusted. And then he just went on doing that. So he took In the Wake after that, and then Outstanding Horses, which we worked very hard at, the English translation. And then a lot of things happened, and then Greivold picked it up. And that was a very nice... I think it sells better. I'm more popular in America than in England, I guess. Mm. They find me in another way. They can be very sort of arrogant sometimes in England.
It's very interesting what you point out, though, because once upon a time, the university press did take on the lesser-known writers while the New York people were publishing Thomas Mann and... Moravia, as you said, and, Günter Grass.
Marquez.
Yeah. Calvino. But, yes, Harvard University Press, the University of Chicago Press still does a remarkable job with this. And some of the university presses buy up the books by places like Siegel, who are doing magnificent translations of lesser-known works. Then... into this very little-known area, because the university presses still seem a little bit fussy, fusty, academic, along come these brassy, independent presses who design the books more excitingly and who get, you know, they're busy. You know, you can't just put them in the bookstores because who's still going to the bookstores? You have to invent new ways, not just to write, but to represent the whole business of publishing writing.
Well, that's one of the things that Geyer does as a publisher, too, that the publishers do, is making sure that the books help find their readers. Mm. And that's part of the job. But I wonder if some of the resurgence of a lot of these smaller presses, and I think we are really in a boom moment, maybe there's something to do with a lack of skepticism maybe about that publicity process that was probably more difficult to overcome, 30 years ago or something. But it's been important to the success of a place like Grey Wolf that places like the New York Times and the New Yorker have started noticing our books, and it's what helps us to keep publishing new ones.
Well, it's a constant fight. Out here in Los Angeles, Semiotext publishes really interesting books that are on that boundary between essay, fiction, political theory, gender theory. They're very exciting books. And, you know, of course, they don't get reviewed by and large until someone has lunch with an editor somewhere and says, look here, we're working so hard. Why aren't you reviewing our books? We're not babies anymore. We're full-fledged publishers. We're in it for the money. Yeah, but we're in it for the money to see if the money can be made to support a press that publishes interesting and brilliant work. That's what we want. And the presses are being discovered, I would say. Young presses are being discovered today the way young authors are being discovered. People are getting into the strange brashness of the guy who runs Tyrant Press. He's become something of a celebrity, you know, and then he goes and publishes Atticus Lish's book. It wins the Penn Faulkner Prize, one of the best prizes, literary prizes in America. Cormac McCarthy won it once. Pynchon even won it. It's a real...
It's a prize with taste.
It's a prize with good taste. Yeah, and a small press published the book. An independent press, as we call it now, because we don't like small. Independent is an American word.
But this is what October does, and I think Guy's philosophy is, because you are such a only purely literary publisher, is that when the books are finished from the editors, then we have the sales department should be exactly the same amount of people with the same force, because after the book is finished, it's money that counts. It's sales and many people reading it. Isn't that right, Guy?
Yeah.
That's what he always been for.
That was Per Pedersen, and now in a goodbye to Guy, the marvelous publisher, about to retire, yes?
Yes, in June.
Do you think that October will survive you?
Yes, I think so. People are so clever, and they have worked there for 15 and 20 years, so they can do the work.
I've been talking with the Norwegian writer Per Pedersen, the American editor Ethan Nosowski, and Geir Berdahl, all of them paragons, extraordinary people in the world of writing and publishing. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Today's producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Melissa Morton. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just with this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Valeria Guiselli is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.